This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.
Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries. And so we have a new Chancellor. What will this mean for the budget? Just 3 weeks away, will pension tax relief be hacked back to a flat 20%? And indeed, should it? Simon tackles this one. Also, we hear about the inheritance tax and care fee nightmares facing two of your readers. And do you drive one of the 10 most popular second-hand cars? And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. or download the app. But first, yes, indeed, we have a new Chancellor. Sajid Javid quit in the middle of a cabinet reshuffle. I won't go too much into the politics. There are plenty of journalists that will do that. But now in steps Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Rishi Sunak. Just 7 months ago, he was a junior housing minister and now has 3 weeks to pull a budget together, a budget that Boris Johnson, by the way, promised would bring a new dawn of spending. So Sajid Javid wanted to level up the economy. There were mooted ideas of raids on pension tax breaks, even a mansion tax as well. So will his successor have similar ambitions? Will he have really much to do, or is it pretty much a fait accompli? What's the role of a chancellor? But before we get into the finer details, wafer-thin CV, politically speaking, I think I called it. But who is Rishi Sunak? And will this change much in the way of government spending plans and ambitions, do you think?
Well, the Saj is dead. Long live the son. The Saj, as we know him by. The Saj, who was one of the Tory...
He knew himself by that.
Yes. Refer to himself as the Saj, hence the fact that people call him the Saj. There are questions over whether we can call Rishi Sunak the son. I'm not sure yet. I don't think he actually calls himself that. The Saj was a contender for the Tory leadership, and he did reasonably well in that. And after the Tory leadership contest, which Boris Johnson won, obviously, Sajid Javid was made his chancellor after Philip Hammond stepped down and said there was no way that he could be chancellor under Boris Johnson, having opposed him on Brexit and various other things. So we then had the prospect of a Sajid Javid budget in November time, I think we were meant to get one. Then that was cancelled because of all the Brexit shenanigans and then the general election. So then we have had a general election and we were then due a budget. We thought we might get one quite quickly afterwards. There was even talk of one in early January, but they decided to go for the traditional March date. We will potentially have a traditional March date budget, but we won't have one with Sajid Javid because he's been given the boot or fell on his own sword. Having had the Treasury try to be taken over by Number 10. So now we have Rishi Sunak. What do we know about him? Son of a GP and a pharmacist.
Right. We seem to know a lot about his family, who his wife was, who his father-in-law is, who his... Who is he?
Well, that's his background.
Yeah, but no, I want to know, what's his CV? Where's he worked? What was he voted for in the past? That wasn't a criticism of you, Simon. I'm just saying, in the context of this conversation, that have you noticed a lot on Twitter about his, you know, his wife? He comes from
Hang on a minute. Right, OK. Rishi Sunak doesn't come from money. Rishi Sunak's dad, as I was about to say, is a GP.
Yeah.
And his mum was a pharmacist, right? Rishi Sunak's wife's father
is
an Indian billionaire and the founder of one of India's most successful companies, Infosys.
Yes.
And his wife, I believe, is that Indian billionaire's only one of only two children. That is definitely notable. It is certainly notable that someone's come from money,
but he has money in the background. That's like every person that stands to make inheritance tax. But you haven't been raised that way.
Hang on a minute. If you're married into a billionaire family, you have a very, very different life.
So before
most
that,
people.
He never would have. So his background would
even
have.
So he
didn't go to Eton. I mean, that's
no.
A start,
he went
right?
to Winchester, and then he went to Oxford and did PPE and got first. And then he went to Stanford, and then he went to Goldman Sachs. And then after Goldman Sachs, he worked for the Children's Investment Fund, which is a hedge fund, which is linked to a sort of venture charity type thing that it's described as, an activist investor that takes positions in companies and then tries to release value by forcing companies to change. He then left there and went to work with someone else who he had worked there with in a new hedge fund, and then he entered Parliament in 2015. And even if you worked at Goldman Sachs and for a hedge fund and were therefore highly likely to have been making millions of pounds a year, and you were very, very rich, if your father-in-law is a billionaire and your wife is a billionaire's daughter, you would still be highly likely to have experience of a life that even those who work for a hedge fund and earn millions of pounds a year cannot possibly dream of.
So what?
Now, that's not to say that he can't do his job. That's not to say that he doesn't come from relatively humble roots, that he hasn't worked hard, that he hasn't got where he's got to.
Is that what we want?
Through his own endeavour.
But it is an extremely
notable thing. It is an extremely notable thing.
So my objection with that is that being the first introductory tweet that I saw a lot when he was put into that position, surely there's something we can say about his politics, etc. But, you know, I just believe that it doesn't necessarily matter about, you know, your money and all that sort of thing. But there we go.
I don't know. Does it matter?
Is it possible for someone who,
when they visit their wife's family, are staying in a billionaire's... Staying in someone who is a billionaire and then presumably has a billionaire lifestyle with them, compared to us who might go to, you know, a partner's family for Christmas and bunk up on the sofa. I mean, there are different life experiences going on there. It is notable. It is still notable in this world that someone is a billionaire.
Notable.
That's just a fact.
But I would also
like
to know
someone's a billionaire.
Who he, in terms of what impact it going to have on the budget.
Well, he's just going to try and make everyone billionaires.
Well, there we go.
We're levelling up.
Boom.
We're going to level up to the point where everyone's a billionaire and we don't have to worry about someone being married to the daughter of a billionaire because we're all billionaires.
What I'm getting at is, do we actually really know anything about this guy? I just think we're talking about this because we don't really know that much else about him. He's so
he's a relatively fresh face. He was a junior local government minister, I believe. He was then chief secretary to the Treasury. Apparently he voted Leave, but it was a difficult decision for him. It wasn't a sort of, you know, ideologically motivated kind of piratical move that it seemed to have been for some of the Brexiteers who quite like the Brexiteer label because they think it makes them sound like a buccaneer. And he, we believe, is a kind of low tax, pro-business, would like to cut capital gains tax, would like to make some of these things a bit easier for contractors and stuff that we're going to talk about, the potential for what might happen in the budget in a minute. We think he's probably a bit of a free markets kind of guy because, well, he worked for a couple of hedge funds.
Right, OK.
And Goldman Sachs.
Well, he's not been in politics long enough to really know in terms of, you know, his voting record and what he's politically speaking. But yes, we're going on his background and that's where he's
also,
said
it's worth saying that it's relevant. Important to know what his parents did, because Sajid Javid never passed up an opportunity to tell people his dad was a bus driver.
Well, I was going to say, bus driver, there you go. Tanya, how much of a say does a chancellor really have anyway? Because we're going to talk about what's coming up in the budget and we'll go into more detail closer to the time, but I do think it's quite relevant now. But how much of a say does he, or is it quite just a titular position?
Traditionally, the Chancellor gets an awful lot of say and are incredibly powerful. And the Treasury itself is probably the most powerful department. It obviously depends on the personalities. The classic case is Blair and Brown. Brown was so powerful that he often wouldn't tell Blair what was going on, even in his own budget, till very late on. So you can imagine that comes with a lot of power. Cameron and Osborne were famously great mates and ran everything past each other and were completely in tune. So the story goes. Mm. It does seem like a power grab by number 10. They don't want a powerful chancellor. They want to call the shots. Whether they knew that Sajid Javid would feel moved to resign or not, they obviously were prepared for it. They weren't going to shed any tears if he decided he couldn't stomach having to fire all his advisers. So I think we can assume that Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings are running the show and Rishi Sunak will do what he's told.
I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here, but I will keep it brief. But what do you two as finance journalists make of the way that it's set up. One would normally think if you're running a business, and just imagine government to be like running a business, you would want everybody in tune and on board. What are your thoughts? How should it be run?
Well, there's going to be pros and cons to each approach. I mean, having someone who is who's going to ask lots of questions and have their own independent view and can question the authority of the Prime Minister and not be quite their equal, but not let everything go to their head. There's definitely benefits in that. And also the Treasury has an awful lot of expertise. I mean, you can argue about all the good and bad decisions they've made over the years, but they have got a lot more resources than Number 10 has got, even with a very ambitious special advisor apparently at the helm. And whether Number 10 deciding that they want to run the show themselves is actually going to work or not, we'll have to see. But it may well be that they'll find out that they can't, and they've been over ambitious in thinking they can do better than the Treasury. We'll find out.
Simon, views? Yeah, you don't have to have any.
Well, it's difficult to really evaluate Sajid Javid's performance as Chancellor because he's not really been a Chancellor for long enough and hasn't managed to
deliver
a budget.
But the role of Chancellor, does it need to be...
The role of Chancellor is very important because it is the second most important position in the government. But the Treasury has a lot of sway. The Treasury can stop things because it can say, oh, no, you don't, we're not funding this. You need people to be arguing the same things, heading in the right direction. But you also need dissent. You need people who are willing to stand up and dissent. You don't necessarily want people who are blocking things for the sake of blocking things, but there doesn't really seem to be being much evidence that Sajid Javid was doing that. He's been a pretty docile Chancellor, if you want to describe it like that. Apparently, he was trying to maintain more fiscal responsibility than was wanted by Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson in terms of splashing the cash, but also managing to cut taxes, but also wanting to pay down debt. And there was a very insightful comment from a source, obviously, in one of the reports that said, what Johnson and Cummings want to do is impossible. You cannot do all three of these things. You cannot increase spending, keep taxes low or reduce them, not raise them, and also pay down the debt. You can't do all three of those things at once. And Sajid Javid was coming from the, we need to rein it in a little bit. We need to play it a bit easier. And it seems that Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings are coming from the, we need to splash the cash and get things moving. Who knows where this one ends up, but you can probably be certain that with the, what lay behind this was the attempt to get rid of all of the advisers in the Treasury and replace them all with a joint set of advisers appointed by Downing Street, where the Treasury could recommend some that they'd like, but Downing Street had the say. So Downing Street is effectively taking over the dissenting department. I do think that it's a shame that it's happened, and I do think that one of the things that I would say, observing this, and I'm not on the inside, I don't know, I'm not a lobby journalist or anything like this, is that the absolute demand for and desire for control and to crush any form of dissent and penalise people who have in some way spoken out and said, I don't think that's the best idea, makes the Prime Minister and Dominic Cummings look weak because it indicates that they can't handle it. They don't like it when people say, we don't think that's a good idea. And if you can't show strength through saying, OK, that's fine, you say that's not a good idea, but I'm the boss and I say it's a good idea, so we're going to do it and it's on my head. That's how you show strength. Just kicking people out because they're saying, I don't think that's a good idea, is not the way forward. But if those people are being deliberately obstructive and causing you problems and meaning you can't do what you want to do, then yes, you probably need to get rid of them. But that's not what it looks like. It looks like they're weak and they can't handle that because they want to have so much control, it shows that they're weak.
But there's the problem is we don't really know what's going on.
But we don't know, do we?
No, exactly.
It will expose them. It will ultimately expose them. Everything will be pinned on them, mistakes, successes. And it's a dangerously exposed place to be. If I absolutely had to put money on it, I would put it on the Treasury biding its time and winning in the end.
I tell you what I'd love to know is 6 weeks into the Johnson premiership with his big majority, obviously he was Prime Minister before that, is I'd like to know what he actually stands for and what his actual plan is and what they actually want to do.
Will we find that in the budget,
because
maybe?
Unless I've been completely misreading the situation, I kind of just see occasional moments of bluster and talking about one thing and then talking about another thing. I haven't seen this. Where is this Churchillian leader who stands up and says, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it? You know,
I'm no sympathiser, but I'm just going to be the devil's advocate on that and say, look, we, you know, there was a bit of an issue with Brexit that sort of happened at the end of January, and then we've got this budget that we're going to be talking about. So, with any luck, he's doing some blooming work.
Well, yeah, but I don't know.
And cabinet reshuffles and all that sort of thing.
Kind of
tell us after the budget.
Some leadership.
If we don't have the Churchillian speeches afterwards, then you
know,
I take it
all
back.
I'm not arguing for Churchillian speeches. I don't want one of those. I just it'd be nice to have some kind of clear indication of what the plan is.
That's always nice, but this is politics. Talking about clear indication of plans and stuff, we had an idea, speculation, some mooting suggestions based on the idea that Sajid Javid had this idea of levelling up the economy. Obviously, he's no more. So will the new chancellor share the same ambitions? Will we get issues which didn't seem very conservative? Is that fair enough? Things like mansion tax, a raid on popular pension tax as well. You're going to have to explain what that is, first of all.
The raid on pension tax breaks was something that George Osborne looked into doing. So I don't know if you could say it's like not traditional Tory, because they've looked at it before. The idea with pension tax breaks is that you save for a pension out of untaxed income. So you don't pay tax as your contributions are going in. And so therefore you get a rebate at whatever your income tax rate is, whether it's 20%, 40% or 45%. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been a lot of talk over many years, and George Osborne looked at this, as I said, about going to a flat rate. So the people who pay higher amounts of tax and therefore get more tax relief back as a result would end up getting less into their pension pots, and basic rate taxpayers, say on 20%, would get a bit more. And the rates that were talked about were maybe between 25 and 33%. It varied depending on who was you know, looking into it at any particular time. But the idea that was floated in the last weekend's press was the most stingy version of that, which was everyone going down to 20%. So obviously higher earners were always going to take something of a hit if you go to a flat rate, but that's about as far as you can go, really. And there's no sweetener for basic rate taxpayers. There's no the broad swathes of the general public will get a bit more
benefit,
in their pension,
yeah.
Which would help to sell it,
so
shall
that everyone
we say.
Goes to 30 or something.
Yes, or 30 or 33% or something like that.
We spoke there about what's happening behind the scenes in terms of lobby journalists. How much of what we hear in these mooted suggestions are genuinely likely to transpire and become, or is it a ploy? Do they throw these ideas out there, see how it lands with you guys and therefore the public, and
possibly,
then go, ooh,
possibly,
that didn't go down
flying.
Too well, let's not
kite
do
flying.
That.
Well, if it's
good
the
phrase.
Well, if it's the pension tax relief one, I'm not sure why they do that every year, because it happens every damn year, just
yeah, you
before
wrote about
the budget.
This. What yeah. did you talk about?
Now, on this year, it's a bit unexpected, because it's not the kind of thing that you would expect from a, you know, big majority, freshly elected, freewheeling Tory government, especially when it was aligned with the fact that there was rumours of a mansion tax, which is a previous sort of Labour and Lib Dem policy.
Yeah, what's mansion tax? But, just remind us.
A special tax for people with expensive houses.
Right. Does what it says on the tin. Nice.
Yeah. But it's very difficult to know exactly what's going on here. Was Sajid Javid really thinking of doing this? Did the rumours come out because Sajid Javid was really thinking of doing this and Number 10 didn't like it? Was he not thinking of doing this and the rumours have been put out to destabilise Sajid Javid? And
who knew pensions
or,
were so controversial?
Were the rumours put out because Number 10 do really want to do it, but Sajid Javid didn't want to do it? Nobody really knows.
Right.
All I know is that I don't think it's good. This is a matter of some considerable debate in the financial world. I don't think it's a good idea, because the principle of tax-free pension saving is pretty much enshrined in the system and goes back to the Finance Act of 1921. And the idea is that you save money into your pension from untaxed income. It's fairly simple, and that means that whatever your tax rate is, you get that relief. Now, that obviously means that if you pay more tax, you get more relief. But the reason for that is because you pay more tax. And actually, by the point you get to getting that tax relief, you get that tax relief on the next pound that you earn, and then you pay it into your pension. But by the time you pay that pound into your pension, you have already paid more tax than the person lower down the scale, by definition. So if you take someone on that higher rate taxpayer threshold of 50 grand versus someone on about 25 grand, they pay, I think, if my maths is correct, I did this the other day, about three times as much tax, okay, as the other person. Now, what is put forward as unfair is because people look at it and go from the point where the amount of relief they get back to that £1 of untaxed income, which is obviously, if you're a 20% taxpayer, you get a 25% uplift. If you're a 40% taxpayer, you get a much bigger uplift because you've got to get back to that pound. But if you look at it from the other way round, and you go, what is the cost of you paying a pound into your pension from untaxed income? For every single one of those people, the cost of paying it from untaxed income is exactly £1. So that is where the system is the same for everybody else. It is actually equal for everyone. Now, you could argue that you should make it a bit less fair for those higher up the scale, so you can make it a bit more fair for those lower down the scale, which is where this 33% uplift come from. And the reason why people like the 33% is because what it effectively means is if you pay £2 into your pension, you get a £1 uplift. And they think that's simple to explain. I think once you start going to arbitrary numbers, you run the risk that people start tinkering with this in the end. You know, you start at what you say. So say you start at the basic rate, you know, with the 25% uplift. Someone then cuts that to 20, then they cut it to 15, then it goes to 10, then it gets taken away completely, or it gets taken away completely for higher rate taxpayers. And you say, well, that couldn't happen. Well, the lifetime allowance when it came in was 1.5 million. It managed to go up to 1.8 million and then fall all the way down to 1 million that it's only just edged above. Also, the concern appears to be that wealthy people are taking advantages to pay lots of money into their pensions. High earners, particularly the very high earners, and this is the reason why I only talk about this in terms of basic rate and higher rate tax, not the 45p tax, have already had quite stringent limits put on their pensions. So you've got a £40,000 annual allowance, which includes the basic rate tax relief. So you can only pay 32 in yourself. But once you earn above £150,000, that's the 45p tax rate, you start getting that taken away from you, goes down to £10,000. This is the reason why we have doctors turning down shifts and causing a crisis in the NHS. You also have the lifetime allowance, which is £1 million. Sounds like a lot of money, but it actually equates to a pension income of about £40,000 roughly, which is a lot of money. But if you were of the previous generation before all this stuff came in on a final salary and you ended up on a, you know, nice, a big high salary, that's a kind of 2/3 salary for someone who was on 60 grand. Lots of those people would be on more than that. Also, I think it's an example of intergenerational unfairness, because this is talked about as taking money off the wealthy and older people, but it's not. It's taking money off younger people. It takes money off younger high earners and younger people who aspire to one day be in that £50,000 plus bracket, because it's taking the money away from them when they have a whole lifetime of saving ahead of them, and means that they're not going to get the same benefits that their parents' generation had, and their parents' generation had far, far, far superior final salary or other kinds of defined benefit pensions. There's also a big problem with this in the form of salary sacrifice, which is the fact that if you salary sacrifice your pension, which a lot of companies use to do it, you give up the money and your company then pays that in. So you get the full tax relief on that anyway. So in order to put in a different rate, they'd have to completely eradicate salary sacrifice for pensions, which would be quite a bit of a headache.
Tanya?
Yeah, there's a further problem with final salary schemes as well, because of the various complications in the way that they are set up and run. But the biggest issue is that because the employers guarantee, they stand behind final salary pensions, the employee contributions go in, and their contributions go in as employers. If all the employees suddenly put in a lot less because they're only going to get 20% tax relief, to stand behind the guarantee of the final salary pension, employers are going to have to put in a lot more. And that has big consequences as well. There's also a lot of other technical issues to do with final salary pensions and the way they work. But the upshot of it is you might need to have one rule for pension tax relief for final salary schemes and another rule for defined contribution schemes. But of course, politically, you could not possibly do that, because then only, you know, people in the private sector would be hit by this change, which wouldn't work.
There's another two things that I think are important to remember here as well. One of which is that, well, firstly, this whole idea of doing this, of taking it down to basic rate, I think actually what they should do is leave it for higher rate taxpayers and increase the amount for basic rate taxpayers, which will cost money, but we're talking about levelling up, aren't we? We're not levelling down here. And if you increased it to that 33% for basic rate taxpayers, that what they would be getting going into their pension would be a lot closer to the real tax rate that they pay, because the real tax rate that they pay is not basic rate tax at 20p, it's basic rate tax at 20p plus national insurance at 12p. So you actually pay 32% tax, not 20%. Whereas as a higher rate taxpayer, you go through that upper national insurance threshold and you pay 42%. So higher rate taxpayers get a lot closer to that than basic rate taxpayers. Secondly, an awful lot of higher rate taxpayers don't actually get the pension tax relief that they're entitled to, because if you are a higher rate taxpayer and you're not doing salary sacrifice, you need to claim it back through a tax return or by writing to the tax man. And loads and loads and loads of people don't do this unless they've been told they have to fill in a tax return by the tax man. Lots of PAYE higher earners, until they get to, once you get to £100,000, you have to fill in a tax return. But lots of PAYE higher earners who don't have any other kind of form of income don't fill in a tax return, never write to the tax man, and they never ever get the tax relief anyway.
All right, we'll bookend all of this, because like I said, we will talk about the budget in further detail as we go toward that date of March the 11th. In terms of this, is that likely, the pension tax rate? What else are you particularly looking out for? Really briefly, just what are the things that you think could happen? What do you think is perhaps on the agenda? And from what you know of Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings, what are we likely to get? A feel, a flavour?
This could happen. It's worth about £10 billion a year. I don't think they could do it without raising the basic rate tax relief anyway. I think they'd have to do the sort of 33% anyway. So that wouldn't get them back that £10 billion a year anyway. To be honest, I think it's too much of a headache for the amount of money that it would raise. And it's very unpopular. It's unpopular amongst people who aren't higher rate taxpayers. It's unpopular amongst people who are basic rate taxpayers. So I'm not so sure it would happen, but I wouldn't be surprised if it did. Stamp duty cut was a big one. The SAG spoke out about stamp duty when he's standing for the Tory leadership. It's a big problem for people buying expensive houses, so therefore it's a geographical problem. But it's a geographical problem that has a trickle-down effect for the rest of the market, because if people aren't buying those... forget the oligarchs in London. But if people aren't buying those expensive family homes in London and the South East, then there's less homes. They don't then sell their homes to someone further down the scale, who then doesn't sell their home to someone further down the scale, and so on. There is a shortage of properties coming to the market. There's less people moving than maybe there should be. Could we see a stamp duty cut? Maybe. I think it would be a crowd pleaser. Inheritance tax, there's call for a complete overhaul of this. There's been an Office of Tax Simplification report into it that says it is hideously constructed and pointed out how much people hate it, even though most people don't pay it. Again, another tax lots of people don't pay, but they don't like. There was this talk of a gift tax, and cutting inheritance tax to 10%. Really bold plan put forward by some MPs. Could it happen? Might do. Doubt it would happen immediately. Probably one of those ones for more consultation, more review. But it has its merits. IR35, this is some stuff that's coming in for contractors, where it is already in place in the public sector, where now the employer has to take responsibility for deciding whether someone is an employee or is actually a contractor. It's to crack down on disguised employment income, people just working long-term for the same organisation or company, right, and paying less tax because they're working as a limited company. It's coming in for the private sector. People aren't ready. Private sector isn't ready. Lots of people don't know about it. Fears it's going to cause chaos, because it caused a bit of chaos in the public sector, particularly for the NHS and the social services, who were facilitating large amounts of people not paying as much tax as they should be whilst dodging their own NI bills. But I think this will probably get stalled, or there'll be some kind of review. And it also relates to this thing called the loan charge, where people were working via agencies that were paying them via interest-free loans, and HMRC has come after those people, but with some heavy-handed demands, i.e. pay back £100,000 within a year or you're going to jail, caused some real heartache, suicide talk and stuff like that. Other things that could be in there, well, a big splurge on the economy and infrastructure and things like that. So basically, watch this space, because over the next 3 weeks, I reckon there's going to be some things filtering out, ideas being floated, kind of
kite
thing.
Flying is always good. Right, well, we're going to leave that to one side, but we are going to stick with, I mean, you talked there about horrible stories. We've got a couple coming up because you've got some readers who messaged into you, Tanya. One of them at start with inheritance tax. It's a nightmare. I mean, I know, just take away some of the figures. This is when a parent plans to leave just one sibling substantially more than the other. Now, I won't read the whole letter. You can go into a little bit more detail if I miss anything out. But it does centre around a gentleman who, by their own admission, you know, hasn't spoken to their father in about 15 years. The father in question was left a big property portfolio worth about $4 million, I believe, by his dad. So the granddad, 10 years ago, now it's transpired, he's written a deed of variation, leaving the whole lot to the younger brother, not yes. to our reader. So the younger brother stands to get $5 million in total, and the reader 25. So basically, the
25,000. 25,000. Yes, versus 5 million.
They want to know: can they fight this?
It seems to be rooted in quite a sad family dispute, and we obviously don't know the ins and outs of that. But obviously, on the face of it, the idea of somebody being left so much less. Mm. It's a very sad story on many levels. In terms of fighting it, with inheritance, people really, it's assumed that you have the right to leave your estate the way you want to. There have been some cases where people have fought that, and there was one very famous case where a daughter did strike a partial victory in battling her mother's will. But on the whole, I think that the courts take the view that if someone wanted to leave their estate in a certain way, they have the right to do so. There's a couple of ways you can challenge the validity of a will, and also if you feel like you haven't been given reasonable provision to basically subsist on, you can challenge it. So on the validity front, it's things like was undue influence placed, was there fraud involved, were all the practical niceties followed in terms of witnesses and so on. And then there's the have you got a reasonable amount to live in, and that's really to protect people who are kind of left destitute by a will. If they're dependent on a parent, for example, or if they're disabled in some way, the courts will look at that in a slightly different way and make sure there's reasonable provision for them.
And
out
in
of
this
the will.
Particular case, do we know any?
The reader in question says that, implies anyway, that he's quite comfortably off. He's, you know, got his own home and he's got a family. It's difficult to know. The lawyer who answered this very thoroughly, and very well in my view, did say that even though the question itself was very lengthy, there's bound to be details in there that you haven't shared. And this area of the law is so complicated that actually you can't say definitively. In this kind of response, he absolutely needs to get a specialist to look at all the ins and outs of it, because there's so many contingencies that you can't say for certain.
Second letter that you had, so I'm just, again, I'm not going to read the whole lot, but it's, I live in the family home, and until last September I was caring for my mum at home, but then she got really unwell, she had to move into a local care home. The cost is astronomical, and I'm currently using my power of attorney to pay for mum's care with her savings, a pension and attendance allowance. Now, there's enough money to keep up the payments until Christmas this year, but they're already, and they go into detail, making big sacrifices on food, on heating, and they're worried about basically being made homeless after Christmas, as the council say they're not going to pay for her care, but will take her home instead.
Yeah, this was such a heartbreaking one. Sometimes you get readers' letters and they really rip you up. Yeah. There are meant to be safeguards in the system so you don't make people homeless in this kind of situation. This guy was caring, you know, for his mum at home, it sounds like, for a long time. I mean, anybody who knows anything about dementia knows what demands that can have on you. And also that when it reaches the point where the parent has to go into a care home, it's reached a really difficult pass, and that's a very heart-wrenching decision as well to put a parent in a care home. It's a really difficult one, but there are some ways that he can put himself in a better position. There's a system of what are called disregards, where the family home won't be taken into account when you're doing a financial assessment, when the council does a financial assessment. And that's if the person involved is over 60 or they're incapacitated in some way, I suppose, in terms of illness or disability or so on. But there's another level beyond that, which is you can ask a local authority to apply a discretionary disregard on the house. And those are where there are special circumstances. But one of the circumstances are, would somebody be made homeless, for example? There's also things like, did they give up their own home to go and care for their parent, for instance, all sorts of special circumstances that might attach. Even if that does not work, you can actually defer the sale of a house. You can come to an agreement with a council about not selling it until after the parent has died, for example. Although, you know, you have to look carefully at the agreement, and the suggestion in the response is that you really need to get financial advice before you enter into that kind of agreement. But also there's the case that if he's been living with his mum for a time, he may have contributed to the mortgage, he may have contributed materially in other ways to the house, and actually, even if he's not on the house deeds, he has got an interest in the house, so that when it is sold, it doesn't all go for care fees, that there might be some that actually goes to him as well, that he's got a right to. So it's a very complicated and involved case. We've really tried to cover it from every single angle to give this reader as much help as possible, because it sounds such a desperate situation.
We'll keep us up to date, and that does sound absolutely horrible. Also, if anybody has any questions that they want you to get an answer to or to look into on their behalf, Tanya?
editor@thisismoney.co.uk.
Splendid. Right, finally, while registrations of new cars slipped another 2.4% in 2019, declining for the third consecutive year, lowest point since 2013, the market for used vehicles has remained, well, relatively steady. A whopping 7.9 million second-hand cars were sold last year, down just 0.1%. So that's around 10,000 cars in 2018. But, let's move the stats to one side. Which models were most in demand? And here's Simon with a countdown. You don't have to do all 10, but give us a flavour of the used cars most in demand because both of us here are very staunch that we wouldn't buy a new car. It's all about the used car.
So your chances of having a used car, your chances of driving a car that is one of the 10 most popular used cars are greatly increased if you drive a model that has been around for a long time. That goes without saying. Okay, some models have been around for a long time and they're not in there. But a mainstream model that's been around for a long time. The thing is, car makers have a tendency to change car names, or they sort of discontinue one model and then they do another. But some of them have some really long-running names that go back quite a long way. So, at number 10, we have the Renault Clio. 126,587 of these sold last year. Why so? It's popular, it's cheap, it's been around for a long time. Most of them are probably going to be relatively recent Clios, but you can guarantee that some of them will date back probably as far as almost 1990 when it was launched. You've then got the Audi A3, the Volkswagen Polo, the Mini. The Mini is not that Mini since it's been relaunched, but it's now been around for quite some time, since 2001, in fact, the new Mini. Okay. Which surprises people sometimes. An awful lot of them have been sold. They're very, very popular. That means there's lots secondhand. BMW 3 Series, people always like those, hold their value well. The Vauxhall Astra. The Vauxhall Astra has a long and illustrious history in this country. That's a name that goes all the way back to the 80s. Every so often, you see one of those 80s Astras. Not so many of them now. They're not that popular new anymore, but there's still enough of them that 243,746 changed hands secondhand last year.
To which I'll pause you at that point and ask, because even if you're not massively into cars, the names that you've mentioned, I don't know, sort of bring a smile to my face. Is it the name, or are they enduring because they're reliable or because they retain their value? I mean, why are
these are big sellers when new. They're hugely popular, big sellers when new.
Or is that it?
No, they won't retain their value. Most of them, their value will drop like a stone. Some of them hold their value better than others. So in the list that I've talked through so far, the ones that will hold their value best, even though lots of them have been sold, Audi A3, premium car, people always want them, BMW 3 Series, and in at number four, we have the Volkswagen Golf. Golfs always hold their value very well, and they just go on and on and on. And there have been eight versions of the VW Golf since 1974, explaining why 260,000 of them changed hands last year. We then have the Ford Focus. Now, the Ford Focus is where we start to meet a name change, because the Ford Focus has not always been with us. The Ford Focus dates back to 1998.
Really?
Remember 1998? 1998 was a great year. The World Cup in France.
Yes,
it was awesome.
David Beckham.
Yeah, exactly.
Not so good. Anyway.
And the Ford Focus was launched. But it was controversial at the time because it was replacing the Ford Escort. Exactly. See, the later versions of the Escort weren't the most popular. The earlier versions of the Escort were more popular and people liked them more, but it was still a very popular car. And replacing the Escort with a completely differently named car that was a completely, quite a different shape at the time was very controversial. Anyway, they've sold a lot of them since. 293,000 of them were sold secondhand last year. In at number two, another name changer here, the Vauxhall Corsa. Yeah. Been around since the early 1990s. Replaced the Nova.
Oh my! Wow.
Yep.
I didn't know that cars change name. Like, is it the same car? They just change name.
No,
or
it's
they
not
get
the same
one...
car. They release a new generation of the car, and instead of going right, this is the new generation
back.
Nova. They go, okay, the Nova is done. We're going to introduce the new Corsa, and usually it's a similar type car. Ford's just done something extremely controversial, where it's replaced what was a sort of quite liked, small, sporty hatchback, the Puma, from the sort of 90s, that was a tiny little light thing that people liked and buzzed around in, with a new car called Puma that's actually a sort of SUV, and people are like, why don't you just give it a different name?
Yeah,
it's not
right.
Puma. Yeah, people get attached to these things.
But because
it's funny.
People like the name, though, so when you were saying these names, I'm thinking, oh, yeah. So
now, in at
the
number
appeal.
One, we have Britain's most popular new car. A name that does date back a long time, a name that the company has decided not to change at all. What is it, Georgie? I'll give you a clue. It means party.
Fiesta!
Yeah, well done. 351,767 of those changed hands last year. The Fiesta name has been around for 44 years. It is Britain's most popular new car. And actually, for most of that time, the Fiesta has been a very good car, so it's no wonder it's so popular.
40 years, wow. Well, you're taking me down memory lane there. Not all the way to 40 years, I'd like to point out. Thank
44
you. 44
years for the Fiesta.
Not that long. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk, or you can download the app. And if you have any comments or questions or issues you'd like to investigate, or you just want to remind us of bygone cars, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk and send us old photos of your car. It has to be old, though. It has to be olden day photos that stand out as being a Fiesta. Me and my Fiesta from the 70s. This is when I got my Fiesta new in the 70s.
Yeah.
If you've got pictures of you with your brand new Ford Fiesta in 1976, send them in to us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Tweet us @thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can join in the debate in the reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.